Okay. So, for the sake of the recording and Bob, I won't call this technically a Dharma talk. I decided to, you can turn down a little bit. I am going to keep working on the questions that a month ago or something, I invited people to write down questions that they would like to see, that like to see me respond to and to us discuss. So I'm going to continue working on those, but I did have two things that I was just going to talk about. And one was, I'm going to start off with posture. So Shintai, would you come up here and sit?
On the hot seat.
Yes, and sit like facing that way maybe okay. For now.
Which posture should I
have? Cross-legged.
Okay.
Everybody's body is different, so I totally understand that, you know, everybody's going to look different across the Zendo, but one thing that you might want to keep in mind is that when we're sitting upright, kind of the ideal is that the shoe, so this, I couldn't find the Kyosaku, I don't know where it is, but this is a fairly straight stick, is that they can have, somebody can come like this and put this upright, and then your head, your spine and your head will be in line, in a straight line, and for, you know, reasonably speaking. And one of the things that is common is that people will, and that requires actually kind of tucking your chin, and you don't want to be stiff and anything like that, but usually what many of us do is either we're kind of looking down, or we're kind of, our chin is jutting out, and that's just, I mean, it's kind of mysterious, but what it, there's something about this physical posture, like this posture, this physical posture is reflected in your mental posture and your whatever. It's like when we're kind of doing like this, I've heard before, you're kind of looking into the past. If you're kind of going like this, you're looking into the future. It affects what we do. So having our spine, and I heard it like it was suspended from the ceiling by a string, and then the vertebrae are just hanging down. And that's something that you can achieve on a bench or in a chair as well, is to think about that straight. But kind of tucking the chin is probably the...
And it feels like it can be just such a small movement and it can feel big, but it's mm-hmm. really a small movement.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
One thing to add to that, you may have met this, but when we put that stick up against Shintai's back as she was mm-hmm. sitting, it's still concave a little bit mm-hmm. here. It's not straight.
Yeah. And another thing, way to think about this is when we sit on a cushion, we are actually... where the point of it is to tilt our pelvis. So when we're sitting like that, if we if we're not sitting on that at all, it takes a lot of physical effort to stay upright. If we just are shifting our center of gravity and tilting our hips a little bit, it's much easier to stay upright. And if you think of the pelvis, if it's angled too far back, we're slouching. If it's angled too far forward, we're kind of hyperextended and stiff. So if you kind of rock your pelvis back and forth, you can find for yourself where that kind of that perfect spot is, that it doesn't take a lot of muscular energy to stay upright. Anyway, just thought it would be helpful to do a little posture tip.
Not putting your head down, you can sit the way you said, but you put your eyes down, so not closing your eyes, but just sort of look down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Way to look down
right. And also the another tip is if you kind of imagine taking in a full breath of air, like the biggest breath you can, and then letting the air out, but without shrinking. So that's kind of the sense of expansion and uprightness that we want. But as you do that, and but then you kind of let the air out and relax. I don't know if this helps you at all. It does me. If you think of relaxing your back, but then it's like your core muscles are what keep you upright. So as much as possible, you're relaxing your back. So it should not really be our back that's keeping us upright. That's what we do. We use our external muscles to keep ourselves up, and my back gets sore. So that's when I have to remind myself, you know, take that full breath, let the back relax, and then it's our core muscles, or like I've heard it said, it's like the muscles in front of your spine should be keeping you upright, and they don't tire out. So so it's going to say something else about Zazen. So I don't know. Over 25 years of sitting, I just keep on coming up with new ways to express what Zazen, what Shikan Taza is about, how to do it. Because, you know, I give intros to Shikan Taza, you know, sometimes twice a week. And there's two aspects to it, where there's that kind of letting go of doing anything or trying to control our meditative experience. That's the kind of letting go part. But then there should also be energy and alertness. And so that's actually, those are hard things to have happen at the same time. So what I've been describing it to people when I introduce it lately is saying, so we're letting go of all volitional activity except for sitting still and upright. So we have our sitting posture, we're just physically sitting. And again, I mean, I may decide next week this isn't the best way to put it, but right now I'm saying, so we're sitting still, upright, and appreciating simply being alive. So for me, that kind of awakens what does it mean to appreciate simply being alive? It means to pay attention to simply being alive, to let go of anything that gets in the way of that, of trying to have this kind of simple attitude. But appreciation, for me, I mean, sometimes I think pay attention to being alive, that can work, but like, paying attention almost has a directed, what should I pay attention to? And it's like, we don't have to do anything to be alive. That's kind of our big delusion, right? That is what we're trying to let go of. To appreciate simply being alive, what does that mean? There's still a part of us like, what should I do? What should I pay attention to? This shouldn't be like this, should be something. There's nothing is required. Nothing is involved. So, I don't know. Any thoughts or comments or anything before I go on to another question?
It's in the instructions for Zazen, the particular one that I love is that be alert and appreciate because your life may end tomorrow and everything you love is changing. Because of that, the following sentence of energized by not knowing the future, that you won't be alive again tomorrow, devote yourself to be the sacred act of being present for each moment without agenda. That I don't know why, but those two it makes me feel, yes, this is awesome. I'm alive today. I'm going to do my best. And if I die tonight, I will die the happiest woman.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I don't have to worry about what's going to happen because I've done my best.
I also, I think you can, you know, do sometimes little things, little pep talks to yourself or exercises, like imagining this is the last time you'll ever meditate or something, can help you with your attitude and your degree of engagement in Zazen. So one of the things I say to myself sometimes is like, just appreciate being alive, appreciate my life just as it is, even though I'm an imperfect person, even though the world seems to be going to hell in a handbasket, even though, you know, I'm not done with this huge list of tasks, even though, like, even though those things are, may be, and everything is in flux and we don't know what's going to happen, even though all that is so, to simply appreciate being alive, because when else are we going to do it, right? I'm going to put it off until everything's just great, everything's worked out, never going to happen. All right, so the one of the questions from a ways back, when faced with difficult thoughts or feelings, not during Zazen necessarily, we might hear someone say, just work with it. Do you use those words? And if so, what do you mean by that? So this is something, you know, I'll do a little reflection on it, and then we can kind of open it up because I'm curious to what people think. So we end up with difficult thoughts or feelings. I think what this might be getting at to some extent is the tension that ends up building up in spiritual practice, usually not right at the beginning. Actually, right at the beginning, things are kind of clear. Like, you meditate and you do some mindfulness, and like it helps, gives you some tools to cope with things. And maybe you have difficult thoughts or emotions, and you actually have some tools that you can use to, you know, help deal with them or process them or maintain some stability or equanimity in the middle of them. But then sometimes we get to the point where we start to feel like we shouldn't feel those things, or basically we should just like work with them and get over them or get rid of them. And I invite whoever wrote this question, if you want to chime in at some point and say, that's not what I meant, that's fine. But so it's in a way we can be a little bit dismissive of our emotional experience as human beings, because we're just like, well, you know, I don't know. And emotions are like, you know, if you're feeling awful, you know, you just, you know, dukkha just means you're like attached to some desire, and if you just let go, then you won't have this problem. And so there's a kind of sense where we can maybe blame ourselves for our difficult thoughts or feelings and feel like we just shouldn't have them or should be able to get over them easily, whatever. So, I mean, in terms of the, do you use these words? It's like, you know, sometimes those words might be exactly what are called for. You know, I don't know if you have, you know, maybe had a, maybe yourself, but maybe it's been a friend or a family member or something who is just, you know, mulling over and dwelling on these negative thoughts and emotions. And it's all about, you know, what's been done to me or whatever. And then, you know, I mean, you may, like I do sometimes, just kind of like, just, you know, just work with that, like deal with that internally in a way, like take responsibility for your reactions and practice with it, because you don't have to just be a victim to these things. So, I mean, in a certain sense, there might be a time and a place for just like, not that I would probably ever say that, but I might think that. But then at another time, you know, that's not the thing to say. And another time there's like, well, I mean, to some extent you might even say, in order to do this practice properly, effectively, we actually need to see clearly what's going on. And if we have too quick an agenda to want to get rid of feelings or judge thoughts or stop the thoughts or something, then we will not actually be facing what's going on. the reality of what's going on, and maybe we're in the middle of processing something. Maybe something awful happened, and we're still feeling the reverberations of that. And kind of no matter what we do, we're not going to be able to get rid of that effect. So if we're too premature about just, let's just work with it, get over it. I mean, I know for myself, I want to do that. I'm telling that to myself sometimes, just like, oh, just get over it. But giving some space for the difficult thoughts and feelings so that we really get, like, I think Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, you know, anger, like holding your anger like you would a baby, you know, acknowledging, or Rumi, I think, says, you know, invite them in for tea. Okay, so what's going on here? How you, okay, that's what you're thinking, that's what you're feeling. Like, we can't actually deal with it appropriately until we let it be for a while. So I guess that's what I would say, is that we have to be careful which we're applying. And that's where, in a kind of a talk situation, we have to be careful what we say about the Dharma and the teaching, because people are in different places. It's a little bit easier to, like, talk to somebody and find out where they are and then say, well, it sounds like you need to kind of practice with that, or just be with those feelings or something like that. So, yeah.
Isn't that in Zen meditation and Zen practices, you internalize your thoughts more than you express them with other people, but then is that not the point of the Sangha?
Yeah, I don't think we really say one or the other. Again, I think that's kind of, there's a time for just reflecting inward, and there's a time for, yeah, talking with Sangha, talking with a teacher, talking with a good Sangha friend. I mean, mostly what we want to pay attention to, I'm thinking, is when we're talking about it with others, what is the result? Are we saying, I'm feeling like this, I'm kind of, maybe I'm a little angry and I'm venting, but my friend is holding that and not inflaming it? So what, you know, what is the result? And do I feel kind of, you know, sometimes it's good to be able to talk with people about what's going on, and afterwards we feel just a little more relieved and supported, and we have some perspective, and we actually feel better able to go on and deal with things. But sometimes we talk to people and it's just made us more bitter and angry or sad or feeling victimized or whatever. And that's like, well, it probably wasn't that helpful. Yeah. And to some extent, there's also, like, I don't know. I noticed in myself, and other people can talk to this, like, sometimes in the past, I've just been uncomfortable with something, and I kind of want to relieve that discomfort by complaining about it or talking to people about it, and at some point I really just have to sit and take stock inwardly and recognize what's going on. So it does seem like there's a time when we really, regardless of what anyone else says, we have to figure out what's going on.
So there's a distinction to be drawn between working with it and working on it. I'd love to work on it, but working with it is the challenge for me. A big part of what I've had to learn to do the last few months is just this weird act of radical bravado where I sort of lash myself to the mast and let it come, and invite it to come and draw it out, the things that I don't want to think or feel, and invite them to explain themselves, which is typically what they actually want to do anyway.
It sounds kind of like when you're working on something, maybe there's the ability to sort of step back from the whole thing and look at it from that perspective and then inquire into it. I mean, really staying with it as much as you can. In my experience, that's well, but if I'm just working with it, I can't step back. It's a sort of a delicate process.
Yeah, that's true. There's like a, I understand what Mark is saying in terms of the, with it be recognizing like this is part of me and my experience. And I like, there's no, you know, executive eye over here that's going to take care of this problem, you know, cause that divides us. But then there's also that aspect of mindfulness where, you know, the description is, you know, ill will has arisen in me, or, you know, greed or desire has arisen in me, like to recognize it. So then we're turning the focus away from the object or subject of our, you know, issue, and turning it toward that experience itself. And when you're like, you know, fear has arisen in me, then we're not completely in it. We're recognizing that it's part of us, it's part of our experience. We can't deny it or suppress it, but it's also not all of us. It's not true in some great ultimate sense.
Stepping back just offers, it becomes, as Mark points out, kind of like an invitation to ask about it, to see what's there.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes I want to turn it into a project and have faces and some kind of goal, and then when I realize I'm not experiencing it, I'm just making a plan, and I love making plans. That's much preferable to me, experiencing it and stay with it. So the acknowledging that, what's going on with me and around me about this thing, is not intuitive. I almost have to intentionally remind myself to be present, because otherwise I'm ready to turn it into a project. You know, I'm ready to get out the catalog and find the seeds and have a plan for what I'm going to plant. But, you know, I want to take action.
Yeah, but busyness is our way of pushing it so far off that we think we are functioning so normally that we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it still comes back again and again and again until you actually do it. I learned that the hard way. I'm also a planner, and that it's so automatic. It's a crisis. I need to do something. I need to do A, B, C, D, E. If I do that, then my mind will be at peace. And once I get to E, it's again, oh, I have forgotten about this. You know, it just continues on and on and on until I just, okay, what is the use of all this?
That must be why it says be wholeheartedly present.
Another analogy is, like, a lot of times in our ceremonies, our elaborate ceremonies, there's, you know, kind of like a mythological level, things are being enacted by those ceremonies. And one of them is like our Sagaki ceremony, where we open the door and we cover all the Buddha statues and we make a loud noise and we invite the hungry spirits in, the dissatisfied, unresolved ghosts, and we invite them in. And traditionally this is done, that ceremony is done in the context of a short retreat, and that's done in the morning, and then in the evening there's like a ceremony of like sending all the ghosts back home. Don't worry, we do a quick sending them home on our ceremony as well. But when I would be sitting on that retreat, I would kind of imagine like opening the doors of my mind, saying, okay, anybody out there? Anybody want to come in? And there's something about, you know, because I feel like without even realizing it, most of the time we're like that, like, we're like, I'm doing fine, I got control over what's in here. Yeah, like, looks good to me. And we don't, you know, like we've kind of shut those things out, and kind of opening that up and recognizing, now what is it? Is it grief? Is it longing? Is it resentment? Is it like, all right, like you said, stripping yourself to the mast, like, okay, come on in. But that got a kind of a conscious effort to make that invitation sometimes helped. If we're, we should probably be in a good place when we're doing that. But that there's a time for that.
You may have said this, or I may have picked it up from Chile on the Curb, his name I can finally say, not pushing them away, but also not grabbing them and going off into the distance, riding off on horses, whatever that feeling is, have been really helpful for me. It's like not pushing them away, but not grabbing them either. Just kind of thinking of this kind of a little bit of space.
Yeah. I like that. There's all kinds of different like metaphors and analogies, and I think that's what, you know, years and experience and practice help you realize, like, you don't have to stick to the playbook, you know, you don't have to stick to the official, like, the official teachings. You can go, like, you get more of a sense of what it is you're aiming at, and then you can find your own ways there and kind of creative ways to talk yourself into the practice.
And do we sometimes, as Westerners and dualistic thinkers, we start saying it has to be either or? I think we get caught in that. It's either got to be going with them or pushing them away. Mm. Like you said, one time is one, one time is another, kind of getting more continuous and flexible.
But
there's weird subtle ways that it can go wrong too, because, you know, I like to figure things out. So that curiosity can very easily become a strategy where I think I'm bearing witness, but what I'm really doing is saying, come and say what you got to say. Now I got your number, shut up and go. and that doesn't work.
One of the things that really irks me is when people tell me mind don't matter. I don't know why, but that really irks me. It's almost where everybody is expected to internalize everything, and if you have anything to say and externalize, this is what I'm feeling now. You know, if it's fear, if it's being upset, if it's anything, people are automatically like dismissal of it. And that particular statement makes me feel very that I'm being dismissed. And perhaps I'm overreacting to it, but it just is a trigger for me.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's like, it's kind of like what Lorna's saying in terms of that, you know, we just get stuck in dualities.
Yeah.
So whether through spiritual practice or sometimes people just by nature, by their character, they're able to just wrestle their emotions into submission.
Yeah.
I mean, or they have some kind of great, I don't know, they kind of have a natural sense of equanimity and they're not as troubled or whatever. So, I mean, yes, there is a sense that, like, we can have influence, right? We can do mind over matter. We can, you know, be full of energy and determined and have a better immune system and be healthier. And, like, it's true. And when we discover that, it's very empowering and it's very, like, yeah. But then we just, I mean, the extreme of that is Christian Science. You shouldn't ever be injured or sick, period. Literally, mind over matter. So it's like people just like, what? No, that's not the way reality actually is. Yes, I'm going to have some influence. Not control. Not entirely. Like, that's a delusion as well. That it's, you know, just... But then there are plenty of people who just feel completely victim to everything. They're just, I have no control over how I feel or how I physically manifest or anything. So that's the other extreme. And Buddhism's the middle way, which isn't a sad compromise. It's we're just refusing to get caught in extremes.
Oh, I love that.
So we're like, yes, we have influence, and we have limitations, and we're human, and we're in human bodies, and our willful efforts are not the only ingredient. There's cultural and biological and, you know, genetic components to our experience that we have nothing to say about. So, yeah. Do you have anything you want to add?
Well, back to kind of that original question, like, so having difficult thoughts or feelings, do you ever use the words just practice with it? I guess kind of already been covered here, but what occurred to me is like the importance of context of that conversation, like really the importance of like if someone's having difficult thoughts or feelings, it can be a new discovery, it can be something that's been plaguing them for years. It can be, I mean, it can be like all of that matters with that. And then the kind of problematic word just, right? That's what introduces a little bit of dismissiveness. Because I think oftentimes I am saying a version of practice with it, both to my others and myself, but with more of an invitation. Like, what does that, can you be curious? Can you turn towards it, kind of lightly touch whatever is arising? Can you just turn towards it in a way that is appropriate for you, pacing for you, supported for you, without overwhelming, but without shying away? But so there's a lot loaded in, do you ever say, just practice with it? It's just as if like context is kind of everything in that.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something. When I first started meditation or mindfulness, it was guided mindfulness. The teacher would say, you have nowhere to go, nothing to accomplish. And so I say that to myself a bit here. But I have nowhere to go, I come here, and I have nothing to accomplish. It's helping me.
Well, this one's kind of related, I think. So it's a good follow-up. So if the opposite of attachment is detachment, how do I remain engaged in life? Maybe this is a question about proper balance, about not becoming too detached. And I, you know, I've been getting involved in climate activism, and I've spent a long time for the Buddhists to come around to that, especially like leaders and teachers. And, you know, to some extent that is, I understand, because Zen teachers, Buddhist teachers, but particularly Zen teachers, I mean, we see it as part of our job to remind people of in what way everything is okay just as it is. Everything is precious and luminous, and there's a ground that, or a stability we can have without having to have any set ground to stand on. So we're kind of pointing people toward the greater, if you will, and not getting involved in the kind of like we're just talking about, like, so we're, it's more of like this inner work as opposed to going out and fixing all the things that are feeling you, causing your stress, right? But then that can be taken to the point where, like a fellow activist, he goes to regular meditation retreats, but he doesn't consider himself a Buddhist. But he was at a retreat, and there was a couple of Buddhist teachers, and at the end, everybody is asking questions in this kind of formal way. And he asked something about, you know, how do you respond to the climate emergency or something like that? And I said, one of the teachers said, well, you could sign a petition. And the other teacher said, maybe it's supposed to happen. And like, I mean, again, in terms of the context and the you know, what are we trying to achieve by saying that? That's not always the answer, We don't always give one answer. So, you know, maybe this teacher saw that this person is really involved in activism and they're trying to point toward, you know, something deeper that doesn't change or something like that. But then again, this is a public setting. So then how that is heard by a whole group of people who don't necessarily have context for what that means. So I mean, I have really, there really are people, and I don't think it's just limited to Zen people. You probably know people who are responding to this crisis that we're in by saying, well, you know, there's been many cycles on the planet. There's been life, and then, you know, it's followed by the extinction, and then life evolves again. And I mean, you can see people are, and they're really actually taking some degree of solace in that. And frankly, I do too, to some extent. I mean, at least I have this sense that life in some form will go on. That gives me some hope, but I would say abiding there is probably too much detachment. Like, yeah, I want to see how that stands up when you're really facing people who are in dire suffering, when you're really facing that loss. Like, I don't really buy it. So yeah. So, and anybody else have? So if the opposite of attachment is detachment, how do we remain engaged?
Material way, because I drive a manual transmission car. It's one of the best things I ever learned, is how to drive manual. I will never go back to automatic if I ever have a choice in the matter. I know, right? But I mean, I want my manual transmission car, I want a clutch, I want a stick. And here's part of the reason for it is I have pretty much absolute control over what my car's engine is doing, what it's putting to the road, and part of that control is to decide I don't want control. If I'm going downhill on the 26 towards the 5, right, towards Portland, I just put it in neutral and coast. I'm still in control of the car, technically. My hand's still on the stick if I need to put it back in the gear, but it's not. I'm just letting it go. It's coasting. My foot's off the clutch. I'm not bothering to do with anything. My foot's off the gas. I'm not on the brake. I'm just a steering wheel. I could let go of that, too, but that road's curved. Bad choice. But if someone up ahead slams on the brake, I can put it back into gear, I can compression brake, or I can go around them. Or you can be disengaged and still in control. You can be out of control and engaged if you have your hand on the clutch and you're in gear, but you don't know how to drive it manually. You're in control. You're engaged. You're engaged, but you're not in control. So the duality is a bit of an illusion there, because just because you're not directly in control of something doesn't necessarily mean you're not engaged, and vice versa.
But the illusion is that you are in control, because you're really not.
At least my car.
I don't know about that. I think being engaged and being detached is incredibly difficult. And especially if that what you are trying to detach from is a loved one. Mm-hmm. Who could be hurting you or hurting his or herself or hurting others. And I have seen it practice, and it is very, very difficult. And I have to keep reminding myself that I don't know enough. I don't know enough to dictate what the outcome should be. And I have to remain completely unattached to the outcome of whatever I'm doing. But someone or something knows best, and all I have to remember is it's not me. So that's the way I look at it. It's hard.
Well, it does matter what attachment means, and in the classic Buddhist sense, the Buddha described it as I, me, and my making. So So you're my friend, or, you know, this is my body, this is my, you know, my house, my job, my personality, my reputation, my, like, we identify this stuff as being part of us. And I think of that as, like, as an inelegant metaphor in the true tradition of Kjogan Carlson, of it's like we're a vacuum cleaner and we're taking these things and they've become attachments to us, like, you know, so like they're attachments and to who we think we are, and that they're indispensable, and if you attack that, then you are attacking me. And the point is that leads to stress and suffering, because then we're always worried about ourselves and you know what's going to happen to us, and life is inherently unstable and constantly changing. So basically, if you have that sense, you're in a constant state of stress and worry about yourself and all of your stuff. So detachment is not doing that, is not trying to maintain this sense of self so strongly and attach things to it. But then we also in English have this other word. When we say attached, we say that's kind of a good thing, right? Where it means emotional connection. It means, you know, I've grown attached to you. Like it is a source of potential suffering because you may lose somebody, but it's not inherently bad. So the way that I think about, like, engaging in that positive aspect of attachment without engaging in the negative aspect of attachment, I guess to think of it more in terms of boundlessness. So usually we have a bounded sense of self. This is me and my family and my people and my stuff. And if we have a more of a boundless sense of self, not that we don't have a sense of self, but that it's not fixed and bounded, then my husband and my pets and this sangha are part of myself. They are part of myself. So when in a way that isn't a bounded, protected I, me and mine stuff, but really and experientially. So if something happens to you, or, you know, I lose you, I lose part of myself. It hurts. So that's like but that we can experience that without it having to be a grasping thing.
I was just going to say, and to further that, if you do engage in some sort of cause sort of larger than yourself, you extend that sense of family or affectedness or however you want to think about that. Uh-huh. And those walls we build up, which is a human nature thing, that us and them start to crumble just a little bit more and a little bit more, which is that where I think the value is of engaging in these larger causes. It is moving the Dharma and that sense of I am somehow different than you out of the theoretical. You know, I'm really not. And now I can actually see that that's the case.
And if we look at... Now, the bigger our sense of self gets in this broad sense, the more we're going to be affected by everything. And so that's why my Dharma uncle James Ford, his book is called If You're Lucky, Your Heart Will Break. But when we have this bigger sense of self, it's not a small, pinched kind of feeling. It's a bigger sense of self that actually then we usually develop more capacity to deal with stuff. It's not as overwhelming and terrifying because it's not just us. We're not alone in this. Well, that's a wonderful conversation, but I should let you all go to lunch. Thank you all.
Oh, this is not a dark one.